certainly has descended across the country.
Today, our very freedom came under attack.
If young people do not see hope, what kind of message are we sending?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. My name is Colin McEwen, and we are about to talk to a diplomat. Today's episode is a little bit longer, if you were feeling, you know, shortchanged by last week. And you'll be hearing directly from our guest, so let's get right to it.
Joining us this week is my co-host, Karine Stanchescu. Karine is the editor for Society, Culture, and International Relations here at the Atlantic Council of Canada. And also joining us, our special guest, Professor Joseph Wong. Professor Wong is Professor of Innovation and Political Science at the Monk School. He's a Canada Research Chair in Health, Democracy, and Development. Has more publications than we really have time to list. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Professor, when you agreed to join us here, you mentioned that you just got back from the PRC. Might I ask what you were there? Was this a new insight or was it just vacation?
No. Every year, every May, I do a course at Fudan University, and it's a joint course between Fudan University in Shanghai and the University of Toronto. So we bring about 20 U of T undergraduate students to Fudan University, and we run a two-week course there. It's a seminar-style course, and so it involves students from U of T as well as students from Fudan University. And it's a great opportunity for us to discuss, you know, pressing issues of global affairs, the rise of China, and gain different perspectives from both Canadian students as well as Chinese students. And then for myself, I also use that time. I go to China often, but I also use those 2 weeks is a time to check in with friends and colleagues and sort of get my finger on the pulse of what's going on in China and what people are thinking and talking about there. So it's a great trip for me all the time.
Okay, so to jump right in, what made you decide to get into academia and academics, specifically political science and global affairs? And how did you decide to focus your research, at least now, on poverty and social policy?
Wow, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, so the truthful answer in terms of why I got into the academy was not unlike many first-year students in university, I did my undergraduate at McGill University. And not unlike many first-year students, I had a very good time. And subsequently lost my scholarship. My GPA suffered, and so I have tremendous empathy for students who find their first year challenging. My GPA suffered, and I thought I would probably not get into law school, and thought about what else I wanted to do. And then over the course of the next 3-4 years at McGill, I double majored in English and political science and discovered that I had a passion for both, and that I really enjoyed doing research. And I thought that I could do original research that would actually contribute to, you know, generating new knowledge. And as I was explaining before, right to the 11th hour, I was trying to decide if I wanted to do my PhD in literature or political science. So I actually wrote two senior theses. One was on Henry James, and the other was on civil society and labor mobilization in China. And in the end, I decided to do my PhD in political science. So what got me interested in that really was, and actually the timing is rather appropriate as we're on to soon the eve of June 4th. So June 4th, 1989, you'll recall, was the time of the Tiananmen massacre, as many would call it, the incident that the Chinese authorities referred to it as. And I was a high school student at the time, and in many ways that was the real political awakening for me, and that's when I became interested in politics.
Did you visit again for the 25th last year?
I go every year to China, and again, I go many times a year to China. And so, yeah, I was there. I wasn't there on June 4th. But I followed events from afar and certainly followed discussions that were ongoing. But back to 1989, I remember actually there was, shortly after the June 4th movement, when many of the dissident leaders were scouted away from the PRC, some of the student leaders actually spoke here at U of T, actually in Convocation Hall. And so I went to listen to them. And again, I think that it was there that my passion for politics and for Asian politics specifically were initiated. So I'm sorry, were there other questions that were in that first batch?
Specifically, why did you start your research on poverty and social policy innovation? I guess this is more later on.
Yeah. I mean, I've always had a very normative interest in issues of justice as it relates to both politics and economics. And so in my first book, it was all about democracy and social policy reform, and that was motivated by not only the politics of inclusion, but also how democratic governments create social policies that would be more socially and economically inclusive. And I've come back to those issues now as I think about the world's poorest of the poor and the challenges that we face in breaching them and how we can actually employ what we know about innovation to try to create new solutions for people, not only in the global south, but here in our own backyards who are suffering or living inhumane lives and the ways in which we can devise new policies and programs to try to rectify those situations.
So towards that end, what other sorts of things you do like on a daily basis, either in the summer or during the year, to that end, as you said?
Well, I spend most of my time doing research, right? So I'm constantly engaging with new material, and I'm constantly being excited by new material. So just last week, I was chatting with my colleague, Stanley Zlotkin from SickKids Hospital, and we were talking about primary care healthcare reform in places like Myanmar. And then a few days later, I met with one of my research assistant teams, one of my RA teams, a group of students who are working on the Bolsa Familia conditional cash transfer program in Brazil, working on a field research trip that we plan on making to Brazil in December. Just this morning, I was chatting with one of my PhD students about her research on adolescent pregnancy in Costa Rica and how that relates to different local political economies. So
it's a wide range of activities.
Yeah, so as a researcher, I'm constantly being engaged with and encountering different kinds of challenges. So I would say in my day-to-day, my work is very much motivated by those kinds of encounters.
It's hard to keep up on everything. How do you constantly
need
to know about Brazil
or Costa Rica? Yeah, it's challenging. I mean, I'm by no means an expert on any of these countries. Yeah. Again, I think I'm motivated by the principles of socioeconomic justice and principles of poverty reduction and how we might think about innovative means to do that kind of work. So I rely a lot on my research assistants. I rely a lot on phenomenal students who they are the true experts. I mean, they really know about Brazil. They really know about Costa Rica. They really know about about Myanmar. I think I can add a little bit in terms of the kinds of knowledge that I might bring to it.
Okay, this is slightly off topic, but we were reading your bio, just information online about you, and we found, what was your experience like working with the World Bank and the UN and advising governments on public policy just all over the world in Asia, Africa?
Well, it's always...
What did you learn in these experiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? Because oftentimes, as an academic... actually, let me go back. One of the main challenges for academics is that we tend to write academic pieces, right? So, you know, and you were both students of mine, you know that we encourage you to condense your thoughts into concise arguments to fit within 5 pages, which of course, as an academic, I have the luxury of writing 250-page books, in which I can be less concise and less condensed and so on, and in the end, less incisive, I think. So, one of the main challenges for academics as we engage in policy work is how do we translate or convey our academic knowledge in ways that are meaningful for people who actually have to do real things in the real world, right? So we can talk about things in the academy as a theoretical idea, or theoretically speaking, we should be able to do X or Y. But in the real world, you know, you have to actually have to distill from that particular lesson or a particular insight or a particular truth that will matter to a policymaker. So I think the main thing that I've learned from all of these kinds of jobs and all of this kind of work is how do I actually translate the work that I do, which is typically at a very academic level, into a language and into insights that are actually actionable, so that somebody can actually do something with it.
It sounds actually not too dissimilar from what we're doing at the Atlantic Council, because there you could research at length any of the innumerable topics. Like one article that published recently was about India modernizing its submarine force. You could talk at length about the technical specifications of this, that, and the other submarine. And you write thousands of words, but this has to be like the length of an opinion piece.
Right.
So, you know, less than 1,000 words.
Yeah. They make us like write it at most 600 or 800.
Yeah, actually, and I think it's actually a great exercise. I mean, as a professor who teaches, who has taught thousands of students, I mean, I think the best experience and the most important skill that you can gain from your university experience is how do you distill from this vast body of knowledge, whether it be technical specifications or deep historical analysis, how do you distill from that what we might just simply call the bottom line? I mean, so for myself, again, as an academic, this isn't something that I'm particularly well trained to do, but I've started writing a blog, for instance, right, for which there, you know, you're only allowed like 700 words, 800 words. And it's really challenging for me to be able to figure out what I want to say in 700 or 800 words when I'm usually given the luxury of 10,000 words for an article or 100,000 words for a book. But it's been a great exercise, and I think in many ways it's actually the most important means of communication in terms of trying to convey the ideas that I want to teach to a broader audience.
Especially now, I mean, with Twitter, you have like 140 characters. It's like, especially now, like no one has the time.
That's right. That's right. So I've learned as an academic, you know, how do you actually use social media platforms, ways of trying to convey knowledge.
From your research, what would you say is the connection between issues of inequality and poverty to issues of security and just international organizations like the UN and like NATO?
If you look around now in terms of the international agenda, whether it be the United Nations or the bank or the newly soon-to-be-created Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, all of these international organizations are aimed at, I think in many ways, creating a new floor right upon which societies, economies, and polities can be built, whether it be rails and roads, or whether it be the Millennium Development Goals so that people, so that children are living past the age of 5. It's all about creating a new kind of floor. So the work that I do in poverty reduction is one slice of this, but it's a very important slice in terms of raising the bottom, in this case raising the incomes and opportunities for the bottom billion, raising the health status of their children into the next generation so that we can fundamentally transform human security and international security. So I think it's actually all very tied together, right? And even though my own work may not deal specifically with traditional security concerns, to the extent that these security organizations are concerned with issues of human security, economic security, looking at, for instance, border security, looking at the flow of migrants across borders most recently. And just think about what's happening in Burma right now with Muslims in the hinterland in Burma. Yeah, the Rohingya who are essentially being shut out. We're seeing seeds of potential genocide. And people who are now in boats trying to find some sort of refugee domicile, right? These are issues of poverty. These are issues of inclusiveness. And they are issues of traditional security and sovereignty matters.
This human security word you mentioned, I keep hearing that more and more. It seems very much in the vein of responsibility to protect, with placing the state kind of secondary, really, to people. Is this something that's gaining traction, either within the academic community or at large?
No, it's an interesting question because on the one hand, you see a growing importance on individuals or communities at the sub-state level, whether they be, you know, defined in terms of ethnicity or religion. So we're seeing a new kind of scaling of how we analyze politics, you know, at the individual level or at the sub-national level or at the regional level, the local level, and so on. And so there is this definite push to rethink how we conceive of politics and economics. But at the same time, we still live in a Westphalian world in which sovereignty is absolutely critical. And so you'll recall in Paul 101 when I talked, for instance, about SARS, right? SARS was a perfect example of human security, of individuals who were transporting illness across borders by sitting on an airplane from Hong Kong to Canada. I mean, you can't get more subnational and individual than that, but at the same time, the major roadblocks to actually stemming the spread of SARS came in the form of state sovereignty, the refusal of some countries of having the WHO monitors in, the inability of states to coordinate data with respect to the Centers for Disease Control. So, you know, on one hand you have SARS, which is a post-Westphalian pathogen, and on the other hand you still have states that rely on borders and rely on the principles of sovereignty to manage those borders. So I think it's a countervailing set of trends, but one that's actually very interesting.
On the side of the state sovereignty surveillance trend you mentioned, actually, just a few hours ago at the time of recording, you tweeted, "Set for hashtag Hong Kong Democrats, even those who want to insult me on Facebook have to get past the firewall first." So, when it comes to this, the surveillance trying to stop these information trends, I know, for example, there are, I don't know if it's called imitations, but it's like, say, Weibo, for example. How are these, what's the dynamic between like these imitations, if you will, being used within the PRC and then Twitter itself being used outside?
Yeah,
how do these all fit together?
I mean, social media is extremely robust in China, so it is true, and it's most strikingly in this last trip to China, for instance, Google is now blocked, and so Gmail is blocked. Of course, the New York Times has always been blocked. Facebook, Twitter are all inaccessible. So there are a lot of globalized social media platforms that are unavailable to Chinese people unless they have a VPN to get around the firewall, which most actually do. Though the Chinese government is actually cracking down on that as well. That said, social media is actually very robust in China. So Weibo is the Chinese version of Twitter. It is where a lot of dissent is expressed. It is a way for the Chinese government to monitor and take the temperature of the mood of people inside China. So it's not as though the Chinese government is clamping down for the sake of clamping down. They're closely monitoring what's happening on social media. It's actually an information source for the government to adapt and to respond, sometimes viciously, sometimes through good policy.
Right.
So, you know, it's an information source for the government. The reference that I made to the Hong Kong Democrat was with respect to a Hong Kong Democratic activist who was insulted on Facebook by a Chinese netizen who proclaimed that he or she had to circumvent the firewall in order to insult this Hong Kong Democratic activist, to which the Hong Kong Democratic activist pointed out the irony of that that you had to actually go through the firewall in order to insult me, and that should be an indication of the kind of regime that you live under.
No.
I think we've actually finished early, so Professor Wong, thank you very much for your time.
No, not at all. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website, natocouncil.ca, for previous episodes, as well as ongoing coverage of events every single day. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube, all of which can be found from our homepage. Next time, we'll be joined by one of our junior research fellows here at the NATO Association of Canada, talking about Georgia, Ukraine, Russia, and more. Talk to a Diplomat, signing off.